You're listening to a highlight from the Yishai Fleisher Show on Voice of Israel.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on Voice of Israel, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. It's Thursday, we're getting ready for Shabbat, and that's why we do one of your favorite segments here on the Yishai Fleisher Show, and that is Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Good to see you, Chuck.
All right, so we have a very packed Torah portion, and of course that's the part of the Torah that we read every Sabbath, every Shabbat. And we finish the Torah every year, the five books of Moses. We're in the fifth book of Moses called Deuteronomy, the second Torah, the second giving of the law. In Hebrew, we call it Dvarim, things. These are things that you got to know. And we're in the Torah portion of Re'eh, which is about 12, 13, 14, 15 chapters, chapter 12, 13, 14, 15 in the book of Deuteronomy. I want to point out first this fantastic phrase, two verses, which are key to understanding the Jewish people's role in the world. It says the following. I'll read it in Hebrew and then in English. Banim atem la'Hashem lokechem, lo tidgodedu, lo tasimu karcha bein einechem lemet, ki am kadosh ata la'Hashem lokecha, uvecha bachar Hashem liyot lo le'am, You are a children to Hashem, your God. You shall not cut yourselves, and you shall not make a bald spot between your eyes for a dead person. For you are a holy people to Hashem, your God, and Hashem has chosen you for himself to be a treasured people from amongst the peoples on the face of the earth. So definitely these two verses point out the singularity and the specialness of the Jewish people. But what I want to point out is that there's three different descriptions for the Jewish people. One is banim, you are children to God. And the second one is you're an am kadosh, a holy nation. And finally, you're an am zgula, a capable nation or a treasured nation. What are these three different kind of titles that really, I don't think they're titles, they're more descriptive of what the Jewish people are, your sons, your holy nation, your special nation. This is exactly reflective of the three names of the Jewish people. We have a name called Hebrew, we have a name called Jewish or Yehudi, and we have a name called Israel. Hebrew refers to the kind of DNA, the ethnicity of the Jewish people. When we're alone, we're called Hebrews. In fact, I just saw it again in the book of Samuel, that the Jews who went to the wrong side, to were pro-Philistine at the time, were called Hebrews because they had lost their Judaism and they were not part of Israel, but they were still Hebrews. They were ethnically Hebrews. That was the greatest proof I ever found for that. And the second thing is the name Jewish, which refers to our, not our hardware, but our software, the stuff that we run, our language, our Torah, our thoughts, our stories, our lore, our laws, all these things are called Judaism. Those are the Jews. They have a different actions because they are Jewish. They're practicing Judaism, or what we call in Yiddish, Yiddishkeit. But finally, we're also a special nation, and that refers to Israel. When we're together, we're able to do things that are a light unto the nations. Only when we're united, when we're one, we become empowered. Here in the land of Israel, when the Jewish people come together, we become an Am Sgula, or Israel. And those are the three different kind of character traits of the Jewish people, on the DNA level, on the software level, and then on when we're united level, the things that we can pull off together when we get together as a tribe, as a people, to do the bigger thing.
And it's interesting to me that you bring this all out in the face of death, right? Because that's the context here, which is always the big question. You know, there's two pshatim, two ways of reading this verse of lo tit go to do, right? You shouldn't cut yourself, right? That's literally what it means. Apparently there was a pagan practice that in an act of mourning, people would slash themselves, you know, but it also means you shouldn't break into pieces. It goes directly to what you're speaking about, right? Like if there's one synagogue in a town, right? And people want to break off and form another, is always a question of what might be a Torah level prohibition of lo tit go to do. We don't break up. There has to be an ability to hold together. So why do people break up? I mean, it's an old joke, right? Like, it's always a breakaway minion and shuls are falling apart. But why do people do it? Because they really feel that they see the world in the right way and the other people see it in the wrong way. And on one hand, this is the great power of all those names that you brought together. It's a tremendous momentum. You know, I often think of myself as a 21st century Jew, at least in this count, or the, you know, the 5775 version. There's a tremendous momentum. It's almost hard to, like, see the present and the future when the weight of the past is, like, rushing by, you know? And so you
What do you mean by that?
You know, like, when I walk around the streets of Jerusalem, I'm often captivated by the fact that for thousands of years, my ancestors have been praying to be right where I am right now.
Right.
So, like, how am I supposed to go to McCulloch and buy milk for my kids when I'm fulfilling a divine promise? You know, or how am I supposed to take seriously the day-to-day political decisions my government makes when I feel they may be failing the vision that God articulates in the Torah? I mean, it's hard to stay local when you feel the weight of what you talked about, you know, this sort of like the hardware, the Hebrew nation, or the weight of Judaism and all the time I spend studying rabbinic texts that are, you know, 1,500, 2,000 years old.
Right.
Am I supposed to think like that, or am I supposed to think like the world today? I mean, the answer is ultimately I'm supposed to integrate them. But the potential for fragmentation there is huge.
Just the other day, I was, you know, when you're having like a kind of, it's not an active thought. You're just kind of, you're drifting. You're not even thinking that you're thinking about something. And I was thinking about a family member of mine who is contemplating marrying a non-Jew,
mm-hmm.
and basically marrying out. Let's be clear about it. And I thought to myself, you know, when you have the argument in your head and you're telling that person something, you're telling them off.
Yep.
I'm like, do you understand the investment that the Jewish people have put into passing this from generation to generation? Do you understand how much millions of dollars have been put into trying to teach Jews Judaism, the schools, the systems, the rabbis, the blood, sweat, and tears that has gone into passing this from generation to generation to pass this baton onto you?
And what answer did you put in this person's mouth?
Whatever. I think she's cute.
Yeah, I think the answer
right.
is. But I think the answer is no, I don't.
Right.
Or even if I do, I didn't ask them to do it, because what you're running up against, I think, in today's world, when it comes to people, you know, marrying non-Jews and leaving the Jewish community, you come up against this prime. It's not even a commandment. It's the most holy, sacred thought of postmodernity, which is autonomy. Which really boils around to, don't tell me what to do.
Right.
And it's a huge challenge. I mean, I see it in my own kids. I see it in my students. I see it in people around me. I carry that weight. I know what you're speaking about, the investment. I'm an active investor as well.
It's been invested in
you.
In
me, and I am attempting to, you know, invest
you
others with
it. You have invested in yourself to connect to that past, and now you're trying to invest in others, and that's your life. You could be doing something else, but
and
instead...
yet the power of this generation is in its expression of don't tell me what to do. I mean, there's a very powerful side to that. I mean, you know, our teacher Rav Kook, I was reading about it this morning, places a tremendous emphasis on the spiritual purity of freedom, right? Freedom is an inner sense, not just a freedom from outer oppression, but an inner sense. Now, of course, for Rav Kook, freedom always led straight to God, because slavery and idolatry are one and the same in his mind, in the sense that they're being bound to false conceptions and that God is truth. But, you know, he was tapping into a strong vein, which can go almost in any direction. Because as soon as you allow freedom to be a central principle, well, people are going to do with it as they will. And it doesn't work. I find that those conversations don't work. I'm banging my head against the wall day and night as a teacher to figure out, how do I articulate these things in a way in which people find themselves in it, where they're drawn to it, where it ignites them, as opposed to the way we were educated, which was, you know, 6 million people died, you better marry a Jew.
I wasn't personally educated that way.
I was. My brother married a Catholic, I think largely because of it.
The way I actually was educated was, to me, actually, I come from what you just described as a Rav Kookian type of thing, which is I come to it from freedom. I come to it from choice, because I like it. And I think that that's a big part of it, which is the cynical world, the doubtful world makes you believe that things that are being handed to you may very well be tainted or false or kind of built on false principles,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you're jaded from them and you're cynical about it, and then you're like, give me my autonomy and get off my back,
and
instead of seeing the beauty in it.
And the sadness is that people have an illusion that they can actually be free. You give me my autonomy, get off my back. Look, everybody gotta serve somebody, as a wise Jew once said. You know who said that?
No.
Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're not conscious of what choice you're making and who you're serving, and you live under this illusion of individual freedom, you don't realize that society's there. Either it's already been pre-installed, what it is you're serving, or it's your hardware, as you referenced before, because, listen, the desires of the body may not take the gross form they took in the time of pagan idolatry when people were cutting their flesh for the dead, but they have pretty raw forms that will more than happily masquerade as autonomy and freedom.
And also that we are very out of control about who we are.
What do you mean?
You're born with tremendous amount of limitations as to what your personality is going to be, what you're going to look like, and to whom you're going to be born, and to what economic situation. You know, this American conception of self-made, on the whole, you cannot make yourself.
No, for sure. I mean, we touched on this last week. If you recall, that we saw the verse, which is the source for the rabbinic thought, Kol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim, that everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. And we said a little bit that that's exactly what it means, is that you don't get to choose anything other than how you respond to what you receive. And how you respond really depends on what story you're telling inside yourself.
So what is how did you tie in the kind of the unity of the Jewish people and the three names to watch out for the energy of death, don't let death...
Because that's... Lo tit gordu can be an individual response. If I can't handle it, so awful, I'm just going to slash myself. That's just a primal, you know, a response, right? But it can also be a fragmentation, right? Like you pointed out that this name Israel is this unified sense. Well, we say every Sabbath at the afternoon prayers, right? Right? God is one. His name is one. And who is like your people Israel, one nation in the land? You know, there's another people that borrowed that phrase. Why? If God is one and his name is one, how can we have like all these millions of people? And why in the land? The answer is because if there's a vessel that's strong enough to hold us together and we refuse to step out of it, and all the problems, the challenges, be it my personal challenge, if I can't handle death, I want to break myself, right? And the Ramban there says the connection between that and being holy people is you got to understand death is not the biggest disaster, you know, and that breaking, or if it's a breaking up of the social fabric. There are plenty of people in our country right now who would be more than happy to look at another part of our country and say, okay, you guys go your way, we'll go ours,
right?
And that'd be disaster. And it's a lack of appreciation for who we are and how we've gotten here, like you said, for all that investment that's been made.
It's also a belief in the hereafter or in history, which are related concepts.
Absolutely related.
Right? It's like you're not just what you are right now. If you are just what you are right now and your wife, husband, child dies, or mom, or dad dies, it can really break you.
Absolutely.
But if you're part of a long chain and you're part of a nation that's eternal, you can't let the here and now break you. And our sages say, even if the sword, the slaying sword is laying upon your neck, Don't
despair.
Don't despair. Don't doubt that there's salvation. It could be your personal salvation, but there's also national salvation. There's also the spiritual salvation. There's something beyond for your soul and your people and this whole thing. So don't be too stuck in the here and now. And therefore, if you're not so stuck in the here and now, you're also not so afraid.
That's right. Because the parallel to the fear of death is the fear of meaninglessness.
Mm-hmm.
Right, meaning it's one thing to actually physically fear death. I think that's fairly natural, right? But I think the great fear that people have is, well, but death is the end, which makes life meaningless because all the work that I do is for naught. And one of the ways that people sort of work around that fear without falling into spiritual doctrine is simply participation in a larger thing, which is why the nation has held such appeal with the rise of secularism. The nation has fulfilled that need within humanity. It's falling apart right now. And we're seeing a resurgence in a desire for connection to the absolute, which is on one hand very primitive, as we can look to our east and see. On the other hand, there is a tremendous sort of fragmentation into like sort of new age individualistic spirituality if we look to our west. And we are once again as a people sitting right in the middle trying to figure out how exactly do you reconcile the wholeness of existence with my autonomy.
You are listening to Spiritual Cafe here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer is the educational director of Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, joins me here every Thursday, and so do you. Or if you don't yet, you should, because it's an incredible half an hour of connectivity and for the Shabbat to get you going there. Love to hear from you. Write me an email, yishai@voiceofisrael.com. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
One of the things that my father teach me was education, that if you study, you can succeed in life.
This is Molly Livingstone from The Big Falafel. Tune in to my interview about the Ethiopian National Project.
I didn't think, oh, my friends, oh, they're white. I mean, my color is black, but I don't think that it's have something more than that. I mean, I cannot base my personality on that.
For the full interview, check out The Big Falafel with Molly Livingstone at voiceofisrael.com.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're on Spiritual Cafe getting ready for Shabbat with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, we're in the Torah portion of Re'eh, which is starts, I think, at about actually a little bit of chapter 11 and then chapter 12 of the book of Deuteronomy. Chapter 12 begins with, these are the laws which you shall keep. These are the decrees and the ordinances that you shall observe to perform in the land that Hashem, the God of your forefathers, has given you to possess it all the days that you live on the land. And this Torah portion will list a lot of laws, everything from how to deal with a false prophet, to how to take tithes, to how to, what else?
What you can eat.
What you can eat.
Animals and...
What you can't eat, right? A lot of basic things. Tithes, I think, are very important. And, of course, the three festival holidays, these national holidays come to Jerusalem. And it's all going to be laid out here in longhand, and you're going to get a good sense of what you have to do. And then it'll go from there to the oral Torah, to the Mishnah and the Talmud, and to finally the law deciders. Lots of law here. But before you get to the nitty-gritty of the law, it says again, I think the fourth time in the book of Deuteronomy, God is going to bring you to this land and he's going to give you a blessing. However, you must know something, which is you shall utterly destroy the places where the nations that you shall possess worship their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every leafy tree. You shall break apart their altars, you shall smash their pillars and their sacred trees, you shall burn in the fire. Their carved images shall you cut down, and you shall obliterate their names from that place. However, you shall not do this to Hashem your God, rather only the place. Why would the Bible say that? Don't do this to Hashem your God. Isn't that implicit? But he says, don't do this to God. And there's a reason why it says this. Rather only at the place that Hashem your God will choose from amongst your tribes to place his name there. You shall seek out his presence and come there. Now, we live in a time right now where some of these phrases that I just read are seen as very ISIS, very unliberal. Where's the live and let live? Why can't we all have our ways of worshiping? Yet our neighbors to the east, as you call them, and to the north and to the south and to the west as well.
there's an ocean to the west.
Right. Well, you know, to the southwest, North Africa, they have a conception that indeed when they capture areas, it's clear to them that you have to destroy the high places of the other nations that you conquer because you're trying to set up a narrative. You're trying to conquer in war, in physical war, but also set up a narrative. And therefore, for example, I don't know, how about the Temple Mount? The Temple Mount, you have a place where there was a Jewish temple. And then when Rome came, they destroyed it. And they put there in their place a temple to Jupiter. Mm-hmm. And later on, it became a Christian temple, and later on a Muslim temple, once again a Christian one, now once again a Muslim one. But everybody knows that when you get control of the Temple Mount, you got to smash the other person's religion so that your narrative can be the victorious one. And yet within the Jewish world, and let's call that almost equal to the liberal world, it seems very unsavory to say you should destroy the high places of the other. And certainly of the Temple Mount, how come we can't just live and let live?
I think that the situation we're in with the Temple Mount indicates the redemptive potential of the return to the land of Israel that we're looking at. Because up until right now, you've just described human history, which is that whoever has the upper hand smashes their enemy in war and sets up their narrative, right? That's the victor tells the story. Right, that's written. History is always written by the winner and all that. And yet the reality is that whole notion that history is written by the winner is contradicted by the existence of the Jewish people. Because we are the people of historical consciousness. And we have held that historical consciousness actually as the quote-unquote loser for the last 2,000 years of human history.
Right.
And it's a tremendously unique opportunity that we have in the fact that from a physical standpoint, within 24 hours, we could clear the Temple Mount. We could knock down that mosque. We could begin the destruction of, the construction of the temple from a physical standpoint. But you and I both know that what's the primary thing that stops us from doing that? Ourselves. Right? Meaning whatever stories we want to tell about, it's not liberal, it's offensive. Oh, what would the Muslim world say? We don't want it. Or at the very least, we don't want it that way. There's a small portion of our people who claim they want it that way. But I argue that if they actually thought it through, they would realize they don't. Because the temple is supposed to be unity. Not a symbol of unity. It's an expression of unity. So by definition, if we're looking at the type of challenge you're describing, then we must not be ready. And the question is, what's the opportunity we're holding here? We're holding a situation where our enemy is preaching hatred of us from the central place of our spiritual service in the world.
What I like to call the capital of our capital.
The capital of our capital has become a platform for the denouncing of our existence. Right? This is like the world inside out. And we must hold that tension and figure out what is unique here. Because as I said, the fact is most of human history, you're absolutely right, the Muslim world has done it, particularly, I don't know how much you know about the story of India and Pakistan, but many of the Hindu-Muslim conflicts in India are because the Muslims knocked down, Indian temples and built mosques on top of them.
Sure.
It was a cultural pattern, which has failed. Even though it looks like it's succeeding, it has failed because they are still soaked in war. And the increasing amount of bloodshed and horror that it takes to maintain that type of worldview ought to tell us that, no, it's a failure. We don't know what it looks like to do the opposite, which is that ultimately the visionary aspect of what the temple is meant to be will be when we are able to tell a story that the whole world can hear. The story is going to have to precede the structure. Right now, what happens is you build the structure and then you start telling the story. Right. And like I said, we have the physical might to do it. But what type of people would we be when we were done? I just ask you like this. If we actually built the temple today, how would the Jewish world react when Sukkot comes around? Would they all come flowing to the temple? Honestly.
I don't know.
Be honest.
I don't know. I mean, it depends how you sell it. If you had Nir Barkat behind it, the mayor of Jerusalem, and you sold it as a great cultural unifier.
As we had to set up, the guards and the regional warfare, et cetera. Maybe when the smoke cleared. Maybe.
I hear everything you're saying, but on the other hand, I also feel like there's a part where you're like, well, you don't want to be like the other. You don't want to be like ISIS. And then there's another part that says, well, it's either us or them.
Nah, and that I don't accept.
Right.
You're stuck in the cycle of history up until right now. We haven't been spit back into this country for the third round in order to just repeat the second one.
Well, we never had a chance to destroy their altars on top of our place.
Not true.
They are literally destroying our narrative
daily.
Not
true. We didn't have a chance. Not true. First of all, we had a chance when Yehoshua crossed the Jordan River. We had a chance during the first temple period and the second temple period. And furthermore, we had a chance in 1967.
Yes.
We had a chance.
Right.
We didn't take it.
No.
And you can't go back.
Right.
And
was that not a missed window?
Even if it was, what are you going to do about it?
Well, nothing, but at least let's...
We're going to beat ourselves up already?
I can tell you what is being done right now is that the historical records of the Jewish people on Temple Mount are being systematically destroyed, and more and more Jewish people are less allowed to go onto the Temple Mount.
Listen, this is a major problem. I personally think that the momentum needs to shift, and that what needs to happen is that the focus of our prayer needs to become the physical visualization of the service which is meant to be done there, and that is going to be the turning point, because until that inner story becomes so real that we can see the temple there, then it will all just be a fantasy of power which we can force on others but will never actually bring redemption.
So you're saying, and I think this is what the Temple Institute is doing, is create the consciousness.
Yes.
Create the narrative first, and then reality will shift accordingly.
Yes, absolutely.
I understand. I understand what you're saying. And at the same time, we are reborn as a nation with an army. And there are certain rights that are being denied to us. And those rights that are being denied are also there to deny the memory and to deny that narrative and to deny that imagination, which you're talking about, in order to get us to yearn for more. And there are many tools for you to yearn for more, to learn for more. There are now prayer books with the pictures of the temple. There's a website. Go to the Temple Institute's website. There's many teachings out there that'll bring you closer to that consciousness. And share that consciousness with your neighbor and friend, with your Jew and your Gentile neighbor and friend. Wherever you are out there, teach it. Yearn for it. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem, for the unity of Jerusalem, and for that temple to be part of all of our lives. Rabbi Mike, I want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Looking forward to hearing from you folks. Write me an email, yeshayahvoiceofisrael.com. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. Shalom.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation, hoping that you've already become a member of the Voice of Israel family of listeners. Subscribe today.